Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. What is the oldest branch of the United States military? The Army? Navy? No. I was very surprised to learn it's neither. It's the Army National Guard, and I was astonished to learn that the date of its founding was 1636, 140 years before the United States declared its independence. Across 380 years, the Guard has been there, composed of citizens from all walks of life, from blacksmiths to future presidents, directly engaged, for better and for worse, in every one of our nation's wars, and in containing domestic turmoil here at home. Gene Prendergast knows quite a bit about all this. He served in the Guard for 47 years in dozens of roles, rising through the ranks to serve for 11 years as the Montana National Guard's Adjutant General. It's a career marked by innovation, commitment, creativity, and compassion. General Prendergast, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Thank you, Brian. Glad to be here.
Where were you born? What did your folks do?
Helena, Montana.
When were you born?
August 19th, 1940.
And what did your parents do?
My father was a bartender, and then he bought a bar on Main Street called the Midway Bar.
And your mom?
My mom was a homemaker. She stayed at home and raised me and took care of my dad.
Any other kids?
Nope, I was an only child.
Looking back on that period, you then was born in 40. You were young when the war ended, but do you remember World War II?
So what I remember, Brian, is the dogs up at Remini. We have property up on McDonald Pass. And when my parents would go up to our property, I could hear the dogs over on the Remini side barking.
And the dogs were barking, they were military dogs?
Yeah, they were the military ones. Oh. Dave Armstrong here in Helena, he was in charge of that up at Remini at
that
time.
Oh, they had a camp of some kind.
Yep, Camp Remini.
Okay, so you go through school in Helena?
Yes, Graduated from Helena High School in 1958.
And joined the Guard?
Right after graduation from high school.
Okay, why?
Well, originally I wanted to be a fighter pilot, so I joined the Air National Guard, went up there and found out I was colorblind. So a job came open in the Army National Guard out the Field Training Equipment Concentration Site, and I transferred to the Army Guard, and I put in for the job, and I got it. And it's very interesting. My first boss was Bob Morgan.
I'll be darned, the artist.
The artist.
Now, what was your first work in the Guard?
I was a storekeeper working with Bob right in the office, and then I became a mechanic.
Of planes, cars, trucks?
Tanks.
Tanks.
Trucks.
Okay, this is in the late 50s.
Yep, all the heavy stuff.
And how was that experience? Had you had experience as a mechanic or, you know, working on your own car?
Yes, I took auto mechanics in high school, and then one of the main things I took in high school that was something I really needed was typing. I mean, we're going back a long ways, Brian.
So I can't read the resume. It would take half an hour. You've done a lot of different things in the Guard. As you look back on it, what stands out in your career as you moved up the ladder and end up as the head guy of Montana's National Guard?
Well, Brian, I was an enlisted man for 9 years, and then I went to OCS.
OCS means Officer.
Officer Candidate School. And then I got a job in the headquarters in the finance, and I started there as a second lieutenant and then worked through the ranks to Major General.
Let's take a step back before we pursue your leadership career and talk about the organization, because I think it's fair to say that in the United States, the publicity, the media tends to focus on the Army, Air Force, Marines, Navy. We know of the National Guard, but we don't know really about the National Guard. What kind of organization is it? State-based, correct?
State-based, but when I was Adjutant General, Brian, you have two commanders. You have the President of the United States for your federal mission and the Governor of Montana for your state mission.
All right, and having two commanders sounds like having two bosses with the potential of conflict. And let me go back into my childhood. My recollection is that in some southern states, the National Guard was called out during the segregation fighting, not physical, not warfare fighting, but this fight over segregation, by governors wanting to preserve segregation, and the President of the United States was pursuing integration, correct?
You're right on.
So who wins? I assume the president, but I don't know.
The federal does because they have the purse strings.
Were you ever in a situation where there was a conflict between the president and the governor?
No, I wasn't.
Okay, and I guess it's fairly rare.
Yes, it is.
So, two bosses. What are the federal duties or the federal mandates that when the president has authority?
The main thing is you trained to go to war with the president of the United States. So when the guard is mobilized to go, say, Iraq or Afghanistan, the president gives us the order, we leave our state mission and go on the federal mission.
Okay, they pay for that.
Yes.
Now, you're dealing with people who are, before that order comes down, how much of the time does the average person, member of the Guard, spend in Guard work outside presidential jurisdiction?
Well, we're citizen soldiers, so we report to the governor, and we were there for floods, forest fires, prison riots, strikes throughout the state government. The governor calls us up, and then we do the state mission.
That's a diverse mission. In your experience over a long period of time, these folks are working in regular jobs.
Oh, absolutely.
So how many hours a week, on average, is devoted to service in the Guard for the state mission?
Well, you train 1 weekend a month and 14 days for annual training, and you train on your federal mission mainly, but you also train for your state mission.
How do you squeeze the 14 days in addition to the weekend work?
If they're a citizen soldier, they usually have to take their vacation time, or they get military leave in some professions.
They get paid?
Yes.
What?
You get paid your military rank.
I see. Commensurate with an Army equivalent?
Yeah, exactly.
Now, how does that work since they're not working full-time? They get paid like an hourly rate the same, a daily rate the same?
Daily rate, the same as the active duty.
So in Montana, with about 1 million people, what is the Guard numbers, Air and Army?
The Army National Guard is around 2,700, and the Air Guard is 1,000.
So roughly 4% of the population of our state. And nationally?
350,000 Army National Guardsmen.
What's the situation with women in the Guard?
In 1968, they were allowed to join the Guard, and I was in that process, and the women are great soldiers.
Interesting thing, just to listeners, if you're interested in the history of the Guard, and it is quite unusual, on their website is a month-by-month history. I've never seen anything done quite like it. So on January 1st, you'll see 1810, 1888, 1914, et cetera, et cetera. Whatever happened on January 1st, then you look at January 2nd. And it's quite an effective way of presenting the diversity and the substance of the participation of the Guard. I will comment at each station break, I'll pick out one or two things that just reflect the surprises that you come across. Sticking with the Army National Guard, what's the reputation of their competence level among the regular servicemen and commanding officers? As you got part-time soldiers training, doing their regular job, they're called up for combat. How good are they?
They're very good, Brian. In fact, the active Army said they couldn't go to war without the National Guard.
Really?
Really.
And to what do you attribute the quality?
I think it's the training the National Guard does. You know, like I said, once a month we have a weekend drill, and then the 14 days, and we go to the same places the Army goes, the National Training Center, down in Fort Irwin, California.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We are talking with former Montana Adjutant General Gene Prendergast about his service in the National Guard. And I said I'd pick some things from the National Guard's website history. Again, founded 1636 as a colonial militia in Massachusetts. Participated, obviously, extensively in the American Revolution. War of 1812, future President Andrew Jackson was a former member of the Guard and played a pivotal role in the Battle of New Orleans, which resolved the War of 1812. And interestingly for me, 1944, Anzio, Italy, major invasion, the Guard was there.
I'd just like to share with you our 163rd Armored Cav Regiment in 1940 went out to Fort Lewis for their 14 days annual training, and they came back 5 years later after serving in the Pacific fighting the Japanese.
So they did no slack cut because you're a Guard member. Once you're in, you're in.
You're in, absolutely.
Just yesterday, by total coincidence, I bought a cup of coffee and then went out in the park and sat down, and there was a memorial to men from Helena who died in World War II, and it's a long list.
It's a long, long list.
Let's talk about what, in hindsight, are highlights to you of your 47 years. You start as an auto mechanic. I'd like you to discuss things that stand out to you in terms of affecting your perceptions of yourself, the nature of service, whatever is important to you.
When I was enlisted for 9 years, like I said, I was really not satisfied with some of the leadership I had, Brian, and I thought the only way you can change it is go to OCS and change it yourself.
Okay, when you say not satisfied with leadership, what does that mean in terms of day-to-day life?
My style of leadership was that every soldier has to know that the leadership not only cares for them as a soldier, but as a person also.
So by implication, you didn't always feel that way as an enlisted man.
No, I had great NCO leadership, and we did have some great officers, but we also had some leadership that I wasn't very fond of.
All right. Now, how do you achieve that goal of letting every soldier know? That's not so simple. Easy to say it.
Yep.
Not so simple to do it. How do you do it?
I think what you do, you get close to your soldiers. You have an open door policy, even as a second lieutenant up to major general, the people knew that they could come and see me.
Can you give me an example?
Yes, a lot of times soldiers come to you when they have issues with family, where they can't make weekend drills, and they can't go to annual training. And you take all that into consideration with your staff and determine if they can go or they have to stay home. And a lot of times there's reasons they have to stay home. Another one was when the women joined the Guard. It wasn't easy for them, Brian, when they first joined the Guard or any portion of the military. They really had to work, I'd say, extra hard to prove themselves.
To the men.
Yep, absolutely. Yep.
Let me ask you this. We're talking about people whose training is for combat, their basic training. Why do you think it matters to a soldier whether the officer cares for him or her personally?
Because you're a team and you have to defend and you have to count on the person next to you. And one of the tough, really tough decisions we had was when the drug policy was in effect.
Which was?
If you're caught with drugs and you go through the urine test, of course, you're automatically discharged from the Montana National Guard.
Hmm.
And it was very difficult because I had people that I know. I had to make the decision that you're no longer in the National Guard.
Morale is an important issue in fighting forces. How did the drug policy affect morale overall, would you say?
Well, the people backed me when I had to make the decision because you have to count on the person next to you, like I said. And when you're driving tanks or aircraft or big trucks, you put your whole unit at risk.
Now you're an officer. So other key experiences that changed your perceptions?
When you become an officer, you're the leader. And you have to teach the people, and you take them into combat, or you, all the training they get, you're responsible to make sure they're safe and taken care of.
Okay, now I know that from just sort of a sentence, just from watching military films. I did not serve in the military. How was that experience for you?
Yeah, I thought it was wonderful, Brian, because I always wanted to take care of people. From the time my mom and dad owned the bar on Main Street, and they took care of sheep herders, they took care of Rankin's Raiders, they took care of ladies of the night. I watched them take care of people my whole life.
That's an extremely interesting comparison to me, because we're talking about bars in the 40s or 50s.
Yep.
You're talking about sheep herders who would be coming in off the ranch for maybe a serious drinking binge.
Yeah.
Okay. Prostitution, people that you're describing as needing some kind of help, and the reflection of compassion on the part of your parents, fair?
Correct. Correct.
Okay. Now, how does that translate? We're talking warfare. It's like the world turned upside down. What's the role of compassion in that environment?
Well, I can tell you something, Brian. I also live very closely to the Native Americans, the Indian people. And I was at an Easter egg hunt when I was about 8 years old. And I got tripped and I fell down and I never got one Easter egg. But there was one Indian young man, he was about 10 or 12. His name was Dean Brewer. And he came over and he said, "Here, Gene, take what you want out of my sack." He was the only one.
That experience obviously still means a lot to you. In something like a combat zone, was it still part of your nature? In other words, is there an opportunity to express that sort of thing, to act on that kind of thing? We think of it, it's a mad world. It's kill or be killed.
Yeah, when we were in Bosnia, we were on combat. I went out on combat patrols with my soldiers, and we were in full battle rattle, which he carried a weapon, and the whole works. And what happened over there, there was a village, and the mayor came to meet me on the outskirts of the village, and he said, "General, I would really like to have you see our memorial in the middle of town, where we had six college students killed by a mortar round by... You know, there was the Serbs, Croatians, and Muslims. And he said, "I would really like to show you that, because we made a memorial for those college students." And the people that were with me, they said, "General, there's no way you should go down there. It's a very dangerous place, and you have to walk about a half a mile." And I thought for a minute, if it was reversed and he came to Helena, Montana, I would take him down to Memorial Park. So I said, "Yes, I'd like to go." And I gave my troops the option that they could stay. We were in Humvees. I said, "You can stay here, but I am going to go down and look at their memorial." So they all said, "Let's go, General." So we went down to their memorial and had the opportunity for that mayor to, he was so proud of. Yes, when we were over in Bosnia and have the opportunity to see your soldiers in harm's way all the time, that always comes back to you, because we flew in a C-130 and they had to do a corkscrew mission where they go and then they land right flat so they evade the missiles. So taken out of there, a missile launched on us, and those pilots in that C-130 did things, Brian, that I'd never thought you could possibly do. But we came back safely, of course.
You mentioned the Easter egg hunt and the Indian who gave you some of the eggs. Now, my recollection is you had something to do with the guard getting involved in Indian health care in Montana as adjutant general. Am I correct?
That is correct.
Tell me about it.
We had an outreach program where I had to go up and get approval from the Indian people. And I can tell you, I've briefed senators, congressmen, four-star generals, all kinds of legislative people. But that was one of the toughest briefings I had to do, because I was asking them if we could come on the reservation and provide medical help for them.
With all that's happened, obviously, between the white settlers and the Indians, that must be a tough sell to convince them that you're sincere.
It was. They were so stoic out there listening to what I had to say. And there were 13 of them at the table, and I'll never forget that. Then they said, "Okay, General, would you step out and we'll take our vote?" And when I came back in, they said, "All 13 of us want to work with you for this."
And what happened? What was the program?
The program was an outreach where we sent our doctors and nurses and medics out to the different reservations. We'd time it around the state of Montana with seven reservations. And we'd do forest fire physicals, sports physicals. We'd do all kind of health checkups for all the Indian people. And being in uniform, they were very receptive to us, because the Indians are the most patriotic people of all, per se. When you ask people to join the army or anything to go to war, they have the highest rate of people that go in the army. I'll share with you one story, Brian, that I was in my Humvee. I was ahead of our people. I was driving. I stopped at this historical sign in Lame Deer, and I got out of my Humvee. Of course, I was in uniform, and this little old truck pulled up, an old beat-up truck, and this guy got out. He must have been 85 years old, and he came over and looked me up one side and down the other and said, You know what happened to the last two-star general that was down here, don't you? Got in his truck and drove away. He sent the message.
That's an amazing story, both his story, which kind of fits the history, and then you say that the Indian people are the most responsive and patriotic in signing up. I neglected to mention in 1636 when the origin of the Guard in Massachusetts, it was formed to, quote, defend the colony against the Pequot Indian, quote, threat. Ironic. You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We are talking about the National Guard with former Adjutant General of the Montana Army National Guard, Gene Prendergast. And I said I would just fill in a couple of highlights from the history. Here's an amazing thing. Marquis de Lafayette, who was George Washington's, basically his son, came back to the United States in 1824-25 to meet with the people who were still in the battalions of the militia that fought with Washington and comprised his army. Amazing. Now, how do you become Adjutant General?
You were appointed by the governor of the state of Montana as head of the Montana National Guard. You are the commander.
Okay, and who appointed you?
Mark Roscoe appointed me for 2 terms and Judy Martz 1 term.
Your term is how long?
4.
Okay. Now, my recollection is you had some involvement in Kyrgyzstan, correct?
Correct.
Tell us about it.
That was the Partnership for Peace. This was an initiative by President Bill Clinton, who wanted to send a peace delegation to different countries throughout the world, and they felt the best way to do it was with the citizen soldier, the National Guard, because they had the civilian background plus the military background. And we were chosen for Kyrgyzstan, which is halfway around the world.
Yes, a former part of the Soviet Union.
Correct.
Mountainous?
Yes, much like Montana, beautiful.
Hmm. People of Asiatic extraction?
Yes, Kyrgyz, yep.
Okay, a big cultural difference. How'd it go?
Went very well. In fact, what we found out, it was a military-to-military operation, and we got to meet the leadership and the people in the Kyrgyz National Guard and the Montana National Guard. And we found out, Brian, that during the Cold War, if we'd have gone to war, we would have been fighting the Kyrgyz because they would have been up on the front lines.
How did that strike you?
Very emotionally for both sides, because we were told the propaganda about the Russians, and they had the propaganda about the Americans, and they're no different than us, Brian. They just want to live their lives with their Minutemen, with their National Guard, and take care of their families. And we found out that all that propaganda meant nothing when we shook hands.
Well, that's a pretty profound statement, because we're talking about roughly 1947 to 1991, a lot of propaganda on both sides to make the point that we're right and they're dangerous. Interesting, just a comment. I interviewed a lieutenant colonel who was then in charge of one-third, I think, of America's nuclear missiles. And he, at some point in the detente period, became friends with a Soviet general Air Force counterpart and would visit his home and talked about his children while they both maintained control of these astonishingly destructive weapons. It was just like, well, it was hard to get your head around that one.
It is. And this is the same way with the military in Kyrgyzstan. And we were there to promote peace.
And how'd it go? What resulted from that?
It's one of the most successful programs in the nation, Brian. And one thing we did that I never thought we could possibly do, but we did it. You know Lowell Bartles, Farm in the Dell?
Yes.
When I came back and gave a briefing on what happens to the developmentally disabled in Kyrgyzstan, he says, General, we can't have that. We got to build a farm in the Dell in Kyrgyzstan. Hmm. And I'll tell you, Brian, that we had to go to the State Department, DOD. I met more people trying to get that approved. And we got it approved, and they do have a farm in the Dell in Kyrgyzstan.
Just from listening to you, it sounds to me like with this decentralized state-by-state guard structure, with the president having ultimate authority, a guy in your position has more flexibility, let's say, than a general in your position. A farm in the Dell is like kind of out of the norm, right?
Yeah, way out of the norm.
Am I correct that you had more discretion?
Yes.
More creative opportunities. Any other examples of what you did?
Yeah, we were able to start our RO Reserve Officers Training Program up at Carroll College. I'm very, very proud of that program. That's where they go to school, and they get a tuition, and they graduate as a second lieutenant, either in the Guard, Reserve, or active duty.
Any controversy that it was a religious school?
Yes. They told me it was too expensive. This was another fight I had to go to the leadership at Fort Lewis and the National Guard Bureau. They said, we can't afford it. It's a Catholic school. And I said, hold on. You got one at Gonzaga, and you got one at Notre Dame. So I feel we have an opportunity to do this. And we were able to do it, Brian.
Now, you also got involved with kids because we did a show a couple of 3 years ago about your Challenge Academy. Many people may have missed that show. Why don't you sum it up for us?
Well, the Challenge Academy is for kids between 16, 17, and 18 that have dropped out of school, and they have an opportunity to get in the Challenge program. The Challenge Academy, it's 6 months on the campus of the University of Montana Western, and then a year mentorship after that.
And the mentorship is one-on-one and one-on-one with one of the graduates.
Yes, sir. And we have about an 80 to 85% success rate with the Challenge Academy. Right now, since we started that in 1999, we have over 2,500 graduates of kids that people had given up on. And how that started, I flew down to Arizona because we didn't have the program. Met with the Challenge program down in Arizona, and I asked my staff to step out at noon hour, and the other staff, I ran with the kids in the morning. We went in, and I ate with them, just them, and I said, why does this program work? And they said, discipline and someone cares.
You served in the Guard for nearly half a century. That's a long period of time. When you speak about some of these incidents, it clearly is deeply moving to you. Looking back on that clearly distinguished career, what stands out? How do you feel about it?
I've had a wonderful life and a wonderful career working with the people of Montana, people across the state, and also across the nation. I've also had the most wonderful family on this journey, Brian, my wife Kathy, my daughter Katie, and my son Michael. They were always there to support me, and I couldn't have done it without them.
General Gene Prendergast, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for your service to our nation and our state, and for being on the radio and sharing it with us. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.